agents who, this is their coin, screenplays. It's what they do all day, is walk around selling screenplays, trying to option screenplays. Those who rep actors are doing the same thing with actors. You call all of them and ask, who is accepting scripts from new writers? And most of them will say, no one. We're not accepting scripts from new writers. We're not accepting unsolicited material. But not all of them will say that. Some will say, oh, you want Bill Harris. Now you've got a name. And now you're starting with Bill Harris. And the truth is, I think, truth with a small t, that you're really starting with Bill Harris's assistant. Because you never get to Bill on the phone. Bill's busy. Bill's busy making deals on scripts he's never read. Because he has people who read his scripts for him, called readers. But your first connection is Bill's assistant, and that's going to be your best friend. That's who the script is going to go to. And then it's that person's job to get that script in front of Bill. And if you do that 100 times, then 5 times, 6, 8 times, someone good will read your script. And if you have put your heart and soul in the script, someone will know. And then good things can happen.
I would say that people don't like to read. You're more likely to get someone to look at a finished film than to read a screenplay.
Absolutely true.
And so what I tell people who ask that question generally is to try to write a screenplay that you can actually make. Go out and make the film. Because you're much more likely to get into the rooms that you want to get into. I didn't do this, I wish I had done it. Is to actually make the film, and that gets you closer to where you want to be, I think, than being a pure writer.
Could be.
I think the business is changing that way.
Pure writer is a hard thing to be. It's especially features. Most of the people I know who write feature films have lives. They sell insurance, they are doctors, they have lives. They have kids and mortgages and cars and houses. The most of the people I know in TV work full-time in TV. They get up, they go to a big room and sit with other people on that show, and they work. That's their job. They're TV writers. Somehow that happened to me, but I wasn't on a show. I was writing television movies. That was in the day when they made a lot of them. It wasn't so long ago that CBS made 72 movies a year, just CBS. They now make 0 movies a year. They have no movie department, which is astounding to me because when I was there, it took up like a whole floor of people, 10 executives, all of the business people involved in that, the executives above them, all of the support staff. I mean, it was endless. It was a floor at CBS, and it's gone. Same with NBC and ABC.
I'm going to open up the Q&A in just a minute. We can go till 5:30 at the latest. I know some people probably have some questions, but I wanted to ask you guys at least one more question. And that is, what's it like living with a script, and it's your baby, and you've done all this particular work on it, and then you hand it over, and you, I guess you haven't seen the finished product yet, right? But even
did you go?
So, are you welcome on set? Are you consulted? And then, when you move on after we get compensated to Richard, like, what's it like to see what they did with it?
The writer is never the favorite person on the set. And the reason the writer is not particularly welcome on the set is because, I had a great reception. They were very nice to me. They shot in North and South Carolina. The first day they shot was 30 miles from where I grew up. But the writer, and tell me if this is your experience, the writer is rarely welcome on the set because everybody knows, particularly the director, that the writer knows the story better than anybody else.
Exactly correct. So my experience is great when the director is my friend. and I have some directors who I've worked with three times. They're my friends. So they say, come on, we're going. And I'm no threat to them. They know I'm not trying to do their job. I'm just there. The director likes to be the center of attention. If you're sitting at a table, and the actors are there, and the director is here, and the writer is here, the actors don't look this way. They only look at the writer. The writer wrote it. The director is interpreting what the writer wrote. So if the writer's there, I'm going to ask the writer. Well, directors need that, unless they're your friend. And so I've had some great experiences where the director has said, no, no, let's ask Rich. And so those have been my most wonderful experiences on the set. I've had 18 movies made, which is a lot of movies to have made in one lifetime. Most of them are terrible. That's not true. Some of them are okay. It's very hard to watch a movie with commercial breaks. Did you figure that out? It's hard for me. Oh, it's the same. It's TV. This is the curse of TV. What else is on? What else is on? And so it's very hard to watch those movies. And some of the movies I don't go to when they shoot them anymore. I think a movie set is, in some ways, overrated if you're not working. It's a long day, and there's a lot of standing around. It's why they give actors trailers. What are they going to do? There's nothing to do. Even the director, much of the day, has nothing to do. The person who's really working all the time, from the minute they get there till it's over, is the DP, director of photography. He is involved in every decision. What a fantastic job that is. So I agree completely with you that it's not the best place for a writer to be unless you are welcome from the onset.
And how much time did you spend on the set of Leatherheads?
Well, because friends and family were so nearby, they shot in South Carolina, and so I would come in for a week or two and go home and spend the night and go back and forth. So I was in, oh, I don't know, back and forth a couple weeks during probably a 7-5 shoot.
They take 14 days to shoot a lifetime. 14 days.
And so you haven't seen anything. You've never had the experience of...
No, but what I did have, Jim Bissell was the production designer, and my first day on the set, it was a newspaper office in they had built stages in an old BMW factory in Greenville, South Carolina, and walking onto the set for the first day and seeing what this production designer had created, I was speechless for hours. I'm not sure this will ever happen again. It wasn't even what I expected. It exceeded my expectations. I was dumbstruck.
That's good. That's a very good point, because sometimes it's happened to me both ways, where you see the movie and you go, oh gosh, is that embarrassing? How could they miss that? They didn't get it at all. It looks horrible, it sounds horrible, they chose terrible actors who are having bad days. The director obviously hated the story and only did it for the money. And then the opposite has happened, where he said, they're better than me. I didn't even see it that good. They're better than I.
Magic.
That's the magic. I agree.
And how about other people revising the material? Did that happen to you at all?
Yeah, we were rewritten a lot. I wrote it with a partner from Sports Illustrated, a guy named Rick Riley, who has the last page in Sports Illustrated. Some of y'all went, Rick's really funny. So I played a straight man. Rick would spike the jokes. He was great. And so Rick and I did the first couple drafts, and then a great number of people started working on the script. We had gotten I got the script to Steven Soderbergh, and Steven Soderbergh got it to Mel Gibson. This is in the early 90s. And Mel said he wanted to do it, but could we wait? He was lined up for two movies, could we wait for it? And we said yes, and we waited for 2 years. And then he came back and said, no, I don't think I want to do it anymore. And at that point, our script, which the studio was saying was a slight polish from a shooting draft, was horribly stale. And then they started throwing all these writers at it. I call it the dark decade. And it just went in the wrong direction, to the point where there was a script that came in a couple, maybe three and a half years ago, that at this point, George Clooney had started his directing career, and George is a big letter writer, so he actually wrote Steven Soderbergh, his partner, who he sees every day at work. He wrote him a letter and asked him if he could direct Leatherhead, since Steven wasn't pulling the trigger on it, and Steven said, sure. Knock yourself out. So George took it over, and then George had a rewrite come in that he was going to take into production, and he wasn't happy with that. And at that point, what did I have to lose? I flew to New York and sat down with Steven Soderbergh on the floor of his new apartment eating Subway sandwiches and say, nobody's been able to get this right since we worked on it. I want another shot at it. He pitched that to George. I did a draft about 3 years ago. Stephen and George liked that, and then George picked it up from there, and here we are.
That's going to be fairly rare that you start something as rewritten by all these people and you get to come at the end.
Well, it was actually really simple, because all I did was basically loop around and reprint the second draft.
And how about you, Rich? Have you been rewritten?
I have rewritten people, and I have been rewritten. I have fought for credit on a film through arbitration. I have won arbitration, I have tied arbitration, and I have lost an arbitration. It is awful to be rewritten. It is a horrible feeling to see it's your title and even your name, if you're lucky, still up there, but not your words in the script. Is a horrible thing, and other writers have different vision than you, so maybe some fundamental things have changed. I don't mean story and character, I mean the rhythm of the story. Maybe the tone of voice of the story has changed. Maybe you can't find yourself in there anymore. So it is an awful feeling to be rewritten, but it is a reality of film. In TV, it's not as prevalent as it is in features. I would say 90% of my films are me credited alone. They don't have time in TV. Write the script, we're going to shoot it, that's why we bought it, we're going to do it, we're already casting it, let's go. There's not that time where, let's think about this, and now how do we want to do it? And
well, the other problem Leatherheads had was because it was a football story, naturally it sort of has to be shot in the fall. And so we would gear up in pre-production, and then something would happen, like the script rewrite wasn't any good, and then everybody would relax. And then, you know, you'd have to build the momentum back up again. It wasn't like it was a timeless story that you could just go immediately into the next draft.
And the way
you could, but they didn't.
Yeah. So, but that's a reality of being a screenwriter. If you don't like to be rewritten, if you don't like to get notes, then you should consider writing something else, because unless you're going to shoot the movie that you wrote yourself with your own money, someone is going to give you notes.
All right, so let's open up for Q&A. Yes, ma'am.
You said earlier that they don't have movie parts anymore. I wondered if that's reality or what.
I get hired by producers come to me. It's never my story. I never set out to write a television movie. I shouldn't say never, but very rare. They come to me with a story that the studio wants to make. In this case, the studio is Lifetime or Hallmark. Those are the two entities making movies, really. Sci-fi makes them some. And they pre-sell that story idea, or the network executive had an idea, and they share it with the producer. And then the producer said, if I'm lucky, the producer says, we could get Rich to write that. And then they call me, and I say, of course I could write that. Are you kidding me? I was born to write that.
Yes.
Yeah.
the question was, what's sort of the co-writing process? Rick and I had worked together for years and years on college football at Sports Illustrated, so we had worked out a little bit, the sport was out a little bit ahead of time. We, the simplified version is, we got it, Rick, at the time, lived in Denver, Colorado, and I was in New York, and we got together in the same room after we'd done as much phone work as we probably had. We got in the same room for about a week, and then worked out this outline that we've been talking about. And then he went back home to Denver, and I was in New York, and the first decision we made was, what scenes are you dying to write? And I tell him what scenes I'm dying to write. And so we write those scenes, and then we literally would sort of hopscotch through the script. I would write a scene or sequence, he would write the next one. He would send me his stuff to edit, he would edit my stuff. And because we didn't write in big chunks, we figured that it would give it more sort of a uniform voice. And we literally sort of hopscotched this through the script to the point where we finished the first draft, and then we got back together. I flew to Denver, we spent a week with Rick, and we hammered out the sandpaper that draft, and off it went.
Y'all briefly talked about dialogue. I'm wondering, is there any other kind of processes and stuff that you go through to try to make characters sound more natural?
Okay, dialogue is tricky. I think it's a lot like music, actually. If you can teach someone to write a song, but you can't teach them to write a great song. So a lot of it comes from inside you, your ability to take on another voice. The first trick is to know your character so well that that person is in your office and real, and you can't hear them. And then you've got to listen really carefully to what you hear and write it down. That's your dialogue. The second trick, and this has always worked for me, it may not work for anybody else, is that I read every line of dialogue out loud and in character. That helps me tremendously. It's not a novel. It's not meant to be read. It's going to be read. I mean, but it's meant to be heard. And so I want to hear it. And I can hear if it sounds right or if it doesn't sound right based on what I know of that character. So if you're reading, if you're not reading, I know it's tedious. You have to read every line out loud and in character. That always worked for me.
The trick with dialogue is that people don't say what they want. And so if you write dialogue that sort of advances the story, it's on the nose. And so you then have to go in and have two characters fighting over a briefcase when it's about
their girl,
you know, whatever it is. So it's something completely different. That's sort of the mystery science.
Before a script goes to an arbitrator or to the big guy, Ben, I forgot who you said his name is, can you rewrite it, toss it, or rewrite it yourself?
Arbitration happens after the film is completed and the producers submit credits to the Writers Guild. And some writer says, I deserve a written by credit or a story by credit. I should be on that movie. I wrote on that movie. And then somebody comes to you and says, this writer said they should be on that movie. And you say, oh, I dispute that. I get sole credit. You know why? Because if I get sole credit, my bonus is twice as much. If I share the credit, I get half as much. I want full credit. I wrote the story. I made the story up. This is my story. That guy came in, he did nothing. He changed nothing. He had no new characters. He didn't write any new dialogue. He changes one little thing, and it goes to arbitration, and you lose. And his name is on your script. And you get half the match. Welcome to Screenwriter.
Did you have a question here?
What were your first jobs right out of college?
My first job was, I went through journalism school and I got a job working for a Hearst magazine called Motorboating and Sailing. I've always sailed. And then I worked for them for 14 months or something, and then that led into my job at Sports Illustrated, because my two beats there were sailing and college football. So I went straight from journalism into the magazine business.
I came out of college and I moved to New York City, and I wanted to be a writer. So I suppose my first job was a waiter, which at least started with a W and ended with an ER. And you know, surprisingly, it only took me 15 years.
I know other people are waiting with questions, but just to sort of a follow-up to that, neither one of you guys went to film school. How'd you teach yourselves to screenwrite?
That's a good question.
I like a lot of movies.
I love movies, and I read. I took classes at the New School in Greenwich Village, screenwriting classes, and I read all those books by Linda Sager and Sid Field and Truby and Haig and Richard Walter and Bob McKee and Screenwriter's Bible, David Trottier. I read all those books. I still have them, and they're all dog-eared and highlighted, and they're all great books. And it was a great way to learn. That was graduate school for me. It's a great question. I find a way to connect. I find something in the script that moves me. Something in there I have to connect to. There can't be unless it's a slasher film, there has to be something in there that I can connect to emotionally, that I get. I wrote for Lifetime Amber's story, which is the story of the formation of the Amber Alert system in the United States. And it's this terrible story of Amber who gets, she's 10, she gets kidnapped and murdered, and her mother devotes the next 6 years of her life, Donna, to creating an Amber Alert for the United States to save other children. Well, I'm not a 10-year-old girl, and I'm not the mother of a 10-year-old girl, but I am a parent. And I found a way to connect to that story in a huge way. And so that was an easy write for me.
Okay, my second question is, what are your thoughts on voiceovers in film and voiceovers
are certain rules you want to modify? I think voiceover is sort of out of vogue right now, but that's not to say it can't be done. I'm trying to think recently.
That's not so recent.
Was it Gone Baby Gone that used a lot of voiceover?
That's just right now, and it does. Adaptation is already, how many years ago?
4? It doesn't, there really are no rules. That's sort of one of the tricks. And as long as it works, no one's going to complain. But the biggest sin of voiceover is when the voiceover is basically explaining what the action is on screen. The best voiceover is counterpoint to what you're seeing. And I think some of the early Woody Allen movies are brilliant at that, because something will be happening and he'll make a joke in total counterpoint to that. So you don't want to use voiceover to essentially propel the story. You can sort of deepen character that way, but it shouldn't simply explain what the viewer is already seeing. There's a good example of that. It's not exactly from there to film, but a lot of DVDs on the commentary soundtracks. The worst ones, the director basically just sits back and tells you what you're seeing. The best ones will give you some insight into character or why they set up the scene that way. So the whole point is it's counterpoint to what you're actually seeing.
I agree. So the answer is, if you can tell your story without voiceover, please do. If you can't, then find a really creative, smart way to do it that does not tell what you're seeing, because you're seeing that already.
Do you adhere at all within the sequence structure?
I don't have any idea what that means. Sequence structure.
essentially a big arc, right? You end up somewhere else other than where you start. And within that big arc are a series of sequence arcs where each sequence, you end the sequence somewhere else other than where you began. And within that sequence are little arcs where the scenes are. And so I guess the sequence arc are maybe sort of those in-between arcs is the only thing I can figure out my thinking.
I don't know. I hope so. I could use it.
Well, yeah, I mean, because what you're doing is you're propelling the story. So you don't want to end up at the end of the scene where you began it. So, I definitely try to use it. I don't really know what it's called, but it's just driving in the vernacular of executives, it's driving the story.
Yeah, here and then over here.
I wanted to ask about
my training was with a minimalist, and he basically said, "Don't tell me how to direct the movie."
Y'all put the camera in.
Yeah.
Try not even to write the word camera in your script.
He would tell me, don't write, this is an extreme because he is a minimalist, but he would say, don't write anything that I can't see on screen.
My philosophy has always been, if you have to describe where the camera is to get your point across, then you haven't written the scene right. It should be completely clear how to shoot that scene. I am forever making sure that the director has nothing to think about.
Yeah, that's
here's the scene. Shoot it like this.
How do you write that? You just describe and
I think you can write, as a screenwriter, German, like biting my lip not to answer this question. But I think, if I can just jump in on this one. I think you can write things in such a way, like what you're saying, that it's very clear how the scene is going to look on screen and how it's going to be directed in your word choice and in your verb choice. You can write a scene that opens on a particular detail, on a clenched fist, and that's an extreme close-up of a clenched fist, and then it opens up and shows other details. You're writing, basically, you see this, then you see this, then you see this, this happens, then this happens, and this happens, and if you use the right words and structure to write those, it unfolds like a series of shots.
But you never say the camera
looks
at this or focuses on that.
I know. The camera is never do.
Never.
No.
So the descriptive narrative and then...
It's hard enough to write a good story, much less direct the movie at the same time.
Yeah.
And the other thing I keep hearing is in a lot of ways, you want a screenplay that's a little undercooked. You wanted it maybe 85-90% because what I keep hearing is you want to give the actors room to create what they need to do. And you want to do the same thing for the director, or they'll feel really crowded.
And the costumer, and the director of photography, and the set builder, and everybody, yes.
So if you want to do all that, just direct your own, write the screenplay, and then direct it.
Yeah.
You're trying to a good foundation to build up, but not to build up.
You're trying to evoke a feeling. You're trying to make the movie feel a certain way.
But you can start with a descriptive paragraph something that describes
the setting. I have a question. Have you read a screenplay?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh.
I was an assistant director for 10 years, so I read many.
I would pick your favorite screenplay. Try to be like that.
Yes.
Yes. You mentioned the way you felt when you had someone rewrite your work. I'd like to find out what your emotion is when you're on the other side, that coming in on someone else's work, and how you feel looking at it, how you see it in your mind, or how you feel approaching that piece.
I first try, I trying to connect with what the first writer was trying to do. What were they trying to do? Then I take the notes that the executive has given me, and I try to fit those in without compromising the vision of the first writer.
Between movies doing feature films and television series, is there one particular area that is easier for a new writer to break into?
Short films.
Short films?
Seriously.
Is that also the best way to go about it?
I think so, because you can do a short film for virtually nothing. You can get Danny to put it in Google Earth and somebody will see it, and it'll creates a certain amount of momentum. And you go from there. And what the trick is, the mistake I've made, the thing that Rich has done, it's about practicing your craft. It's about going out there and writing every day, or better yet, making movies every day. You make a commitment to it, and make that short, and it either flies or it doesn't, and you go into the next one, and then go from there.
I think it's a goal-driven answer. It depends what you want at it. If what you're looking for is a full-time job, like clocking in a bank, then you want to be in television series. That's a job. That's a full-time job. You go to a place, to an office every day, and you work there. It depends on your goals. If you already have a great life, but you love to write movies and you'd love to get a feature film made, that's great. I think that's a great choice. You can write them, try to get an agent. The agent will be looking for material from you. You'll be having your whole life and doing Little League and all of that stuff with your kids and still writing movies. But they're very different goals. And I think that also determines the course of your life. So if you want full-time writing as your life, you must live in L.A. because that's where they are. Maybe you could live in New York. There are some series there. But the vast majority of that work is in Los Angeles. If you want to be a feature film writer, you can live anywhere and do anything.
Okay, I've written a short film. I produced it.
Someone who produces these movies? ABC Family?
I don't have
that. Then I don't know what to tell you. Yes, the answer is
talent,
or somebody who can. If you don't know someone who can get the movie to ABC Family, then you have to find an agent who will do that for you.
How do you limit your character in your setting? If you got too much going on, you want to put it down. How do you cut together after cut down and then go for yourself? Like if you're writing an independent film, you don't want a bunch of actors, you want to limit the actors.
That's budget driven, you're saying.
Yeah,
well, if you have enough money for three actors, don't write six. Yeah, that makes sense.
You know, I find that I think some people do their best work when it's kind of like you were talking about having to have the discipline, that structure, the TV breaks, that was sort of liberating. I think sometimes you can do your best work, it's like, you know what, I can only make a movie with three people, two locations, and then those restrictions are a catalyst for your creativity. And I think it's smart to start off by giving yourself those kinds of restrictions and doing everything you can with it, because I think sometimes it's difficult when the sky's the limit. It's harder to be creative when you've been in those. It's sort of the second album syndrome. I think a lot of students do their best work in the class when you can say, you can make this movie, but there's only 10 shots, and you have to this kind of lighting, and you have to have only one line of dialogue. It really sparks creativity. I think that's the approach we take.
There's some great examples of that, like go watch 12 Angry Men. They're in a jury room. There's 12 men in a jury room, and they set up different. It's an amazing movie. What happens within that room? That's a good example. Some of the early Mulish Forman movies are great that way. The Fireman's Ball. It takes place basically all in one ballroom, and it's very minimal, and yet it does a whole lot.
That There must have been some movies that you've written that never made it onto the screen. Can you tell us a little bit about one of those, maybe?
Well, all of the feature films that I wrote never made it to the screen, although they've been optioned. So I wrote a movie called Persona Non Grata, which has been optioned maybe 5 or 6 times over the last 15 years. But it just never seems to get made. And so is that the question? I feel like I answered the question.
Yeah, just something that's never been viewed before.
Yeah, and then what's worse, though, that doesn't bother me as much as when they hire you to write a television movie, and you write it, and you hand it in, and it's greenlit. It's said, we're making this movie, and they put it on the desk of the person who's going to make that movie, and that person is fired. Or, and this is true, I had 3 movies on the desk. Les Moonves, you don't know that name? You should be reading it in the paper, CBS, King of CBS. I had 3 movies on his desk, and the president of film for ABC at the time was Sunta Isakupo, very nice woman, wonderful producer. She had greenlit 3 scripts of mine, 3 on his desk, and he announced CBS is no longer in the television movie business. So that was hard.
The silver lining on that is it's not always a bad thing, because what you can do is put it on the shelf. A script will fall out of fashion sometimes, or business changes, or stars change. Put it on the shelf and start another one. And eventually you'll be in a meeting and someone will say, well, what else do you have? And you've got a shelf full of scripts that are complete.
That's if you own them.
And there are many writers that have made a career as a writer but never had anything in the screen.
That's right.
Some of them are very bitter fellows that let's see, anybody that hasn't asked a question? Dan?
Hopefully I'll be eating more.
What's in your refrigerator?
A lot of beer. That's what they say. The one thing I've learned is I've gotten to be a little skeptical. So I'll believe it when I see it. I have a friend who's from a mafia neighborhood in Providence, Rhode Island. He said, you know, the difference between you and me is that you were raised to trust people until they do something so horrible that you mistrust them, finally mistrust them. He says, I mistrust everybody until they give me a great reason to trust them. And he says, in the movie business, I'm much better served.
I think we have to wrap it up now. If we could just have one more question. Did you have a question, sir? No?
I did.
Yeah.
My question, it's 2 small questions. I was wondering if you guys would talk about the process of adapting. Maybe adapted a book or a short story or article, and any pitfalls, because I'm currently down that road. And then the second quick question is for Duncan. Sports question. Does Michigan have any chance of beating Ohio State in 2 weeks?
No. But I'm dying to do an adaptation because I've been doing originals, and there's nothing more brutal than an original because you're having to create something out of nothing. And brutal is the key word for adaptation, is you want to, adaptation of a book or play doesn't have to be a faithful adaptation. You can't transfer the book into the screenplay. You have to make it its own being. And to do that, you have to make some brutal decisions. If you compare To Kill a Mockingbird, the book, to the movie, I'm sure they're wildly different, except in spirit. You know, I think the movie is so well loved because it exactly captured the spirit of the book. And I think that's the goal in adaptation, is to capture the spirit and then do what you have to do to make the screenplay work.
That's quite right. I've done many. And from Main Street by Sinclair Lewis, down to newspaper articles about the Amber Alert. in television, they're almost all adaptations in some form or another. I've done plays too. And Duncan is exactly right. It is its own living, breathing thing. If it requires new characters that were not in the original, you got new characters. You cannot fit one medium into another. There are different requirements in a book than there are on the screen. So they do not translate. So Duncan's exactly right. Your job, as it is within the script itself, is to find the essence of that story and tell it.
Okay, well, in closing, can you offer a few words of advice that you might give to the aspiring writers or working writers out there? Direct.
I would say, here's my only advice. Don't write what you know. That's what everybody says. Write what you know. I don't buy it. With the internet now, you can know anything. Give me an afternoon, I am an expert in anything. I have endless resources to find information. Don't write what you know. Write what you love.
And the other thing you want to do is you want to live life. There are a lot of screenplays, you probably read a lot of stuff, where you can tell that the people's only experience in life is from watching movies. It's important to get out there and try to hit the edges a little bit.
Words to live by. All right, thank you very much for coming here.